This morning, I'd like to continue discussing the story of Hui Neng, known as the Sixth Patriarch, a figure who it's generally acknowledged is now either partially or wholly fabricated as a kind of archetypal exemplar of a Zen teacher. And our question is basically, if you are going to make up an archetypal Zen teacher, what would you want him to look like? And why would you tell the story this way? What are the features of the way the story is told that illustrate what were the crucial concerns in his time about the nature of practice and realization? Now, we said last time how he was said to be an illiterate peasant, where his illiteracy sort of immunizes him against all the intellectualization that Zen is supposed to be against, a special transmission outside the sutras. So as an illiterate, he knew none of that, although all it took was to hear a single line from the Diamond Sutra for him to awaken. I tried to find that line and saw a couple different versions. One might go something like, let thoughts arise that abide nowhere. The idea that thoughts are wholly empty. They attach to nothing. They ultimately refer to nothing. And so we'll see how that particular line and that idea gets reflected in one of the most famous stories about Hui Neng, which is the poetry contest that is supposed to been set by the fifth patriarch to determine his successor. And the head monk at the time is said to have submitted a poem that was put up on the wall of the equivalent of the bulletin board of the monastery. And his poem said something like, the body is like the Bodhi tree, the mind like a mirror on a stand. Carefully polish the mirror. Do not let any dust alight. And so we can presume that this poem reflects something about the standard picture of what practice is, what meditation is, that's going to be challenged by the poem that Hui Neng asked to be written as in response to that. See, it's interesting that when we think about these monks, we really have no idea what they were doing, no idea what they called meditation. We can be pretty sure they weren't sitting there counting their breaths. We can be pretty sure that they weren't sitting there doing mu, since this is a few generations before the birth of Joshu. Koan practice hadn't been formalized or established yet. So what were they doing when they sat there? And really, how much sitting there were they actually doing? We know that contemporary monks may spend the vast majority of their time either in physical labor, simply supporting the life of the monastery, growing food, so forth, or performing services and rituals. The monk's role may have been much more a matter of recitation than quiet meditation. If you think of the life of a contemporary Trappist monk, what's built into his schedule is work and the recitation of the office at many times during the day. It goes into choir, they chant the psalms, they chant various verses. Originally, it didn't build in a lot of what we call silent meditation. It was communal prayer and chanting. And these monks may have had a life maybe closer to that than what we imagine happens in a Zendo now. But if you look at the poem, it seems that one of the things that is being addressed is a kind of project of quieting the mind and purifying the mind. The mind is like a mirror, and the ideal seems to be a perfectly clean, reflective surface that is easily contaminated by dust. What's the dust? Our thoughts, our emotions. Somehow, practice must be about wiping that mirror clean, keeping it empty, keeping it pure. So maybe this is a kind of standard picture of practice that the author of this story is trying to set up an alternative to. And I think that we certainly can identify with that model in the sense that quieting the mind, clearing it out, emptying the mind. To this day, that's most people's basic idea of what meditation is supposed to be about. And I think it continues to be, if not people's explicit practice, at least part of their curative fantasy about what meditation can or should ultimately do for them. And, you know, if you ask people, did they have a good sitting? They usually say yes, and when they think I was very calm and my mind was clear. And bad sittings are when their mind is spinning and they can't quiet down and so forth. But we get the alternative picture from Hui Neng, who had, because he's illiterate, had to have this poem read out to him and dictate an alternative for someone to put up there. And his version was something like, originally there is no Bodhi tree or mirror. Both are empty, non-existent. Where possibly can any dust alight? So what he's doing with his kind of alternative is to try to negate this whole apparently self-obvious equation of meditation with quietism or purification. The mind is originally empty. A thought, the mirror is not something that can be sullied or contaminated. Our job isn't to keep it clean, because the whole notion of purity versus impurity is itself the problem. We're not trying to dispel one half of a dualism and replace it by the other. We're trying to break out of that alternative of cleanliness and dust. Over the years, I think I developed my own version of that attitude when I say that the mind is not contaminated by its contents. Whatever it is we're doing here is not a purification process. But some of you may remember, I think in Joko's first book, she talks about this story. And she says that, as a matter of fact, really, we have no choice but to practice as if we're polishing the mirror. What we do when we label thoughts is that kind of meticulous attention, moment after moment, to thoughts. And what we're doing is not trying to wipe them away or empty our mind, but by labeling them, see them just as empty thought, to see them like that verse in the Diamond Sutra that he originally heard, let thoughts arise that abide nowhere. See the thought as empty, transient. We don't have to do anything about it except see its true nature. To cling to the thought is to get caught up in the content of the thought, to think that the content of the thought matters in some way, that there's a problem that we have to figure out, either how to make it go away or how to do something about it. To see the thought as empty is to see that it poses no problem whatsoever. It's no different than the chirping of the birds outside the window. So Joko thought that what we have to do is simply watch or label these thoughts, not to make them go away, but to just see them over and over again, just as thoughts, just as thoughts. And that really, at moment to moment, that's how we have to practice. We can't do anything to try to make lightning strike and have the kind of sudden revelation of the emptiness of everything. All we can do is practice moment after moment with each thought as it arises. So if those verses try to give us an alternative to purification and quietism, the other story that's most famous about the sixth patriarch and gives rise to another famous koan shows something about what it meant to have a student-teacher relationship and what would bring about one of these sudden moments of insight. Keep in mind that nowhere in Hui Neng's story do we hear anything about him ever sitting in meditation. There's nothing equivalent to Dogen's idea of the identity of practice and realization, or Zazen and realization. We don't know if he was ever even allowed in the Zendo. He was a just a worker, a lay brother, someone working in the kitchen. But because of this verse, the fifth patriarch recognized him as his successor and gave him his robe and bowl to symbolize the transmission. But he warned them that none of the other monks would accept this and that he should leave in the middle of the night without anyone knowing. See, even in this transmission, it's important to notice he's not ordained. He's simply recognized as having insight. And so, again, you may have some idea that who's ever writing this story is trying to say something about the usual form of, you could say, clerical patronage and succession, that perhaps the whole system of who was the abbot and who succeeded the abbot and how much did this have to do with real insight or how much of it was bureaucracy and how much of it was patronage from the emperor. Something about that usual system must have been felt rotten, that we're telling this story about transmission being completely separate from the ordinary temple hierarchy and bureaucracy. In any case, Hui Neng takes the robe and bowl and hightails it out of town. But the next morning, it's discovered that he's gone. The old teacher doesn't want to come down and says, the Dharma has gone away. And the monks all gather together and realize that Hui Neng has left, and they decide to go after him. And the story is that they were led by a monk who in his previous life had been a general. And this man is this fierce, formidable character, and he leads the posse, you know, chasing Hui Neng out into the forest. And after a certain amount of time, they catch up with him. But Hui Neng sees them coming, and he takes the robe and the bowl and he puts it down on a big rock in a clearing in the woods, and he goes to hide. And the general stops everybody, says, hold it, I'm going to take care of this. And he approaches by himself to pick up the robe and the bowl. But when he tries to take them, he finds himself paralyzed. He can't lift them. Something happens. He realizes, for whatever reason, he's not entitled to pick up these symbols of transmission. And as he stands there frozen, not knowing what to do, Hui Neng comes out of his hiding place and says to him, right now, just in this moment, without thinking either good or evil, what is your original face before the birth of your parents? The tables are strangely turned here. See, Hui Neng tells him, you can't lift the robe and bowl, but really, they are only symbols. They are not the real thing. He's essentially saying to him, you've got yourself caught up in a kind of very literal curative fantasy that you can actually have this gaining idea of getting these objects, and that's going to make you a teacher. But it's not like that at all. But if that's not the case, what is? What's the core matter here that we're trying to grasp a hold of? So here you get another picture of what do we imagine is involved in realization, and how is the story designed to go against the grain of that? The obvious one is this sort of literal gaining idea of getting the robe and bowl. That's sort of the very concrete, literal version of the gaining idea. But the other more subtle one here is he asks him, right in this moment, thinking neither good or evil, what is your original face before the birth of your parents? What does that mean? What is that asking for? See, I think one of the things it points to is our fantasy of depth. To ask for something before the birth of your parents is to say, go back into the mists of time, go back into this kind of space of eternity or the transcendent world, right? Go back to the very beginnings of things. Well, who or what are you then? What is this original face, right? Where are you going to look for that? Deep inside? What does it mean? Where would you find it? See, this in a sense is a kind of mirror image of that gaining idea. The idea that there's something deeply hidden, esoteric, to be discovered. If the truth is not in the robe and the bowl right here, it must be something very strange and esoteric and hidden. But the old general monk, when he hears that question, something happens. He says he breaks out in a cold sweat and suddenly he gets it. And I think this moment becomes, again, a kind of model of the idealized interaction between a student and a teacher, in which they arrive in a state of desperation, they're sure they know what they need, they're sure of what they're after. But something happens to undercut or cause to collapse that whole curative fantasy. When he finally realizes it's right in front of him, but he can't pick it up. The whole idea of that gaining curative fantasy is blown apart. It's not going to work. Well, what's left? Thinking neither good or evil. Stop thinking of me as the good guy and you as the bad guy or any of that, right? What's happening right now? And so what the patriarch is doing is pointing him to what he's saying actually in the question itself. Right now, in this moment, where is your original face? Well, it's not hidden. It's right here in this moment. If we go back to the original verse of the Diamond Sutra, where he had his original enlightening experience, arouse a thought that abides nowhere, right? There's your original face, something that arises abiding nowhere. Just this. The empty mirror, the empty dust. Just this. See, we can call what happens to the monk in this story sort of the epitome of what gets to be called great doubt, the kind of collapse of your curative fantasy to the point where you've thrown everything you can into trying to do the thing you think is necessary, and it hasn't worked. Where are you then? Well, that's the moment when you're potentially most receptive to not getting anywhere, to being finally completely and totally present, because all the avenues have been blocked. All the routes you think you need to take have gone nowhere. All you do is stay right here, right now. So what we get in this story, to sum this up, is we go from this picture of practice as quietism or purification, the calming of the mind, the clearing out of thoughts or feelings, the kind of cultivation of the clear mirror. That mirror has to get shattered in some way, because then what you're left with is your original face, which is nothing but this moment.